Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Starting shows this way at 10:06 a.m. has become kind of a habit for me lately, don't you think, Bruce Lee?
It has become a habit for you, but I'm delighted that it's a habit for me to be here with you.
Me too. Bruce Lee is a professor of family medicine at the University of Kansas Medical Center. He's going to talk with us this morning about habits, the good, the bad, and the so necessary we don't even think about them. Bruce, how do you define a habit?
Well, a habit, intuitively, a habit is something we do over and over again. It's something that is a way of acting or behaving. But even more interestingly, it can be more abstract, like a mental habit. Bad mental habit would be a habit like having prejudices or hating things or the habit of thinking things that make you angry. So those are bad cognitive habits. Good cognitive habits might be, you know, looking at the bright side of things, looking more objectively at things, having a problem-solving mentality. So all different kinds of habits, good and bad, abstract and concrete.
What is the relationship between habit and routine? Are those two different ways of saying the same thing?
We develop habits by maintaining routines. I would think of a routine as including the whole context. I have the habit of starting my car after I get in it, but that's following the routine of leaving the house, going out to the driveway, getting in the car. So arbitrarily, I will say that a routine is the whole shtick and the habit is each individual step. How's that for?
Each joke in the shtick, maybe. Yeah, I like that. Well, so much of what we do in any given day feels very automatic. And I wonder why that is. Has humanity always functioned this way, or is it something that the modern world has kind of brought out in us?
I think that for humanity to survive, we have always needed habits.
Why?
Well, I didn't anticipate that you'd ask me that, but I picture cavemen and women looking in the refrigerator, looking in the icebox or whatever they had, then seeing that that they were down on whatever buffalo meat or food for the night or the week, and I'm sure it was automatic that they said they picked up their bows and arrows or sticks and stones and they went after what they knew they'd need a few hours later or a few days later.
Well, so habits are a major part of our lives, and they can be good or bad. How do we determine whether a habit is helping or hurting us?
The way that we determine that is what the long-term impact is. Our bad habits are typically meet some very short-term desires. They provide instant gratification. You know, it's instantly gratifying to stick my hand in my pocket and again pull out my keys, and that won't hurt me in the long run. So that's a good habit. But the habit of sitting around watching TV for hours on end. And then finding it hard to walk upstairs because I'm winded because I didn't exercise, you know, that's a long-term payment that I have to make because my habit was being a couch potato. So it's the long-range outcome that really determines whether an outcome is good or bad.
With an immediate gratification kind of behavior and a long-range outcome, does everyone necessarily connect the dots between the two? I mean, you might connect the dots between not exercising and not being in shape, but would you necessarily connect the dots between the time you spend watching television and the time you don't spend exercising?
Well, let me give you an example of how people don't connect the dots. I have been in a situation where I've had to hire people, and I look at their resume and I see that they have gone from job to job to job over their lifetime. And in the middle of an interview, I'll notice that they have kind of a negative attitude, say, about prior employers, or they have a negative attitude about work conditions. In an interview, I'm sure they're not sitting there thinking, my negative attitude is the reason why I lost my job or lost my jobs. So people have so many bad habits that they don't realize they have. A lot of them are interpersonal habits. Something more concrete like cigarette smoking. A lot of people wake up the next morning after smoking at night and they have a lousy taste in their mouth. But the more abstract habits, like how you get along with people, a lot of people never connect them with the losses that they have in friendships and love and all that stuff.
The interesting thing about what you're saying is that, is it equally hard to notice a good habit when you have one? I was thinking about this over the weekend, knowing that we'd have this show, and I was thinking about how easy it is to be hard on yourself about the habits that you haven't quite formed that you want to. But all of the little things you do, because they're habits, you don't think about them. And because they're not hurting you, you aren't sitting there reflecting on them necessarily.
We don't pay attention to our good habits. As you were saying that, I had this image of a parent teaching their child to say please and thank you. That's a great habit to have, to express gratitude for what we have in life. And I doubt people say please and thank you and then stop and go, wow, I'm glad I have that really good habit.
Well, so how do you do a really productive kind of self-analysis, examining your own good and bad habits and leveraging what you've learned from forming the good ones to maybe get rid of the bad ones and replace them?
I believe in living a mindful life.
Explain that. What is it? That's a term that's really interesting.
Okay. Mindful means that you pay attention to what's happening in the moment, from moment to moment to moment, rather than going through life mindlessly. Now, living in the moment doesn't mean that while you're driving your car, you're doing deep breathing exercises and counting the breaths. There's a good chance you'll get into a wreck if you do that. But I believe in living a mindful life, one where you pay attention to what is all around you at any moment in time. And so in doing so, if you live a mindful life, you'll notice whether things are going well or badly, whether you feel good or feel bad about things. If you feel bad, it's probably because you've engaged in a habit that doesn't work for you. If you feel a good example, at the end of a meal, feeling very, very, very full. Very few people walk away from in our modern times, people with money, with means, very few people walk away from a meal going, gosh, I'm still hungry, unless it's intentional because they're dieting. But if people live mindful lives and they pay attention to the good and the bad feelings they have, as they have them, they will probably engage in identify more bad behaviors and engage in more good behaviors.
Can people go overboard with this? I think about certain friends I've had who have gone through phases that are, they're so admirably trying to correct every flaw, every bad habit, engaging in self-improvement really aggressively, to the point where, though occasionally, it feels like its own bad habit.
I've seen people really really derail themselves by falling into a movement, say like a self-help. It's almost like an organized religion. I will not mention any of them, though several names go through my head of organizations, but where they promise you enlightenment and they fill you with hundreds of things that you can do to be enlightened, and then you try to do all of them. It doesn't work.
And it feels a little like self-flagellation.
It's self-flagellation, but it's also so artificial. It's not internalized. It's not every change in life. In things that really matter, every change needs to be somewhat gradual. And so I have trouble trusting massive change that happens in a hurry. That's why people shouldn't crash diet.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman, visiting with psychologist Bruce Leese about habit formation, the good, the bad, and the ordinary that we don't even recognize. Bruce, you've brought in a few top 10 bad habit lists from different sources, and the differences between these lists indicates to me that there really is a certain amount of subjectivity when it comes to this stuff, or maybe just that different bad habits are more prevalent in certain cultures than in others.
My face hurts from smiling as you say that, because I stumbled across, let me just tell you, Reader's Digest and a guy named Marshall Goldsmith, who wrote a book about habits, and then the Times of India. So I stumbled across those and you know, pulled together all these bad habits lists. And the difference, I was a sociology major in college, the difference in societies, I've highlighted. You know, the obvious ones for all cultures are overeating and overspending and smoking cigarettes and all that stuff. Those are all bad habits. But some of the subtle ones that we don't think about in our society, Times of India talks about nose picking and wearing high heels and sleeping with makeup on. I mean, this is in the Times of India, the main, you know, one of the primary papers there. excessive lying, nail biting, ignoring sex.
Now, excessive lying is an interesting one because I almost think of that in a category that veers off into something much more serious than a bad habit. And of course, a bad habit could be very serious, but lying feels like a something that's a deep character trait that you can't shed necessarily like a habit.
I'm glad you brought that up because as I was listing those and chuckling, I was thinking about how serious this topic can be. I would say that most of the people I see in clinical practice are there because they've been lying to themselves. I agree with you that it's characterological. It becomes who the person is. It's their personality. But even more importantly, it's an inattentiveness to reality and an attempt to recreate a reality that the person thinks is more comfortable. So it's so refreshing to have someone who's late come in and say, wow, I just didn't plan well. That's why I'm late, versus the person who says, you know, there was a lot of traffic. Yeah, and construction. And I once, one of the funniest things that's ever happened to me in my practice, I was young and foolish 20-something years ago, and I was seeing a kid, not even a teenager, and I was late, and I said, I'm really sorry. I might have been 8 years old. I'm really sorry I'm late. I gave them all those things I just said. And this little eight-year-old. This little 8 year old says to me something like, well, why didn't you just leave home earlier? So the habit was lateness, and it took a mindful child to get me off that habit. It stuck with me forever.
Let's hear about some of the things that are on the Reader's Digest list and the Marshall Goldsmith list. Anything that they share in common that's a top 10 bad habit?
Yeah, there's a lot in common between the lists, of course. So unhealthy eating, watching too much TV. I always argue for watching no more than 7 hours of television a week, an hour a day, if you want to sit on the couch on Sunday for 7 hours, but really trying to limit it to 7 hours. And if somebody says, well, what scientific study brought that conclusion to you? I'd say none. I just thought it just made sense. So watching too much TV and too much fast food and skipping breakfast, too much alcohol, cigarette smoking, these are all good ones. But the big difference between the Reader's Digest version of bad habits and the Marshall Goldsmith version of bad habits, Reader's Digest keeps it really simple, behavioral. You know, it's something you're putting in your mouth or money you're spending, versus the Goldsmith one, which is interesting because it talks about making winning too important, the overwhelming desire to give our own opinion, passing judgment, making sarcastic comments, much more, I think, sophisticated and important habits that we humans develop.
It sounds like a difference between cause and effect, like he's identifying the cause of what Reader's Digest is observing, which is an effect of that kind of thinking.
And it's interesting that you say that because I used to do quit smoking clinics at KU Med. And when I did them, I was shocked at how many people said, I smoke cigarettes because I get really angry. I'll go out there and kind of smoke at a problem. Like I'll be taking these big puffs and exhaling with anger at somebody I was irritated at. So you're right.
The real habit there would be an anger management kind of habit.
Anger management or just problem solve, the absence. A lot of times a habit is a compensatory strategy. It's an effort to compensate for the absence of skills. So if you don't have the skills to say to somebody, you know, at this point you have interrupted me so many times that I want to just pull my hair out, instead of saying something like that, probably without the pulling my hair out part, instead of saying, you know, please don't interrupt me because I want to finish the story, you might get frustrated, walk outside, light up a cigarette, feel more relaxed, come back in and never deal with the real problem. So it's compensatory, compensates.
Interesting. Well, so when it comes to ridding yourself of a bad habit, or maybe more importantly, forming a good one, what are some pieces of general advice, or is there such a thing as general advice? Are the habits too different from one another to do that?
That's what's fun about this topic for me as a clinician, as a teacher, a researcher. There are lots of common threads between all of these different habits that are very, very important. To answer your question, because habits are mindless and automatic, I don't know that I've used that word yet today, but they become automatic. What has to happen as people change habits is that they have to become more mindful, less automatic, and therefore more deliberate. So we learn, if we're trying to overcome overeating, we learn to eat more slowly. We're told to taste every bite, to count our chews. Those are all strategies to try to make eating more mindful. So mindfulness, generically, in general, that would be my first recommendation. Towards that end, certainly recognizing and targeting the bad habits, saying, you know, this has got to go. And what's interesting is when we do identify bad habits, we have to be very careful not to negate our own selves as humans.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, if I am, if I'm 100 pounds overweight, it's really important for me to say to myself, you know, you're doing some things to contribute to this obesity, rather than saying, you know, you're a fat pig to myself.
So don't be mean to yourself.
Don't be mean
while
to yourself.
Noticing the problem.
That's a very good way to put it. Don't be mean to yourself. Don't beat yourself up.
What's the danger in that? Because some people might think of it as like the tough coach or something. Their tough inner coach is going to like just berate them into changing habits.
Unfortunately, that's the way some people are raised. Some people are raised in that they are told that, you know, only stupid people do that. Or you're so stupid or you're so fat. The danger, here's the big picture. In order to overcome bad habits, we need to have a certain level of confidence in our own ability to do that. So if I were a cigarette smoker and I wanted to quit, I'd have to believe not only in my ability to quit smoking, but my own sort of agency, that I could be my own agent, that I could be my own best advocate. I have to believe in myself. And if I am self-defeating in my thinking, I won't believe I can do anything.
Do you think, though, that just decide, is there a possibility that a person can just decide to change habits and be so committed to that that it's going to work? Or is that wishful thinking?
I had a mentor, a brilliant, brilliant man named Alan Marlatt. He was nationally recognized as the father of relapse prevention. He died a couple years back of cancer, but brilliant, wonderful man. He was being interviewed on one of the morning talk shows, TV shows. And they asked him how he knew if somebody was going to quit smoking or eating or whatever. So he looked at the host and he said, what's a habit you want to quit? And the host said, whatever, smoking, whatever. And he said, what percent likelihood is it that you'll quit? And the host said, well, about 70%. And Alan Marlatt said, nope, you're not going to quit. You have to be at 75% or more.
Whoa.
Yeah. So if you want to change a habit, anyone asking me, with help for changing a habit, I ask them, what percent likelihood is it that you will change? If they say less than 75, I know. I don't say, well, you won't do it, but I know there's a less likelihood that they'll change their bad habit.
When I was 11, and I have no idea what triggered this, but I became preoccupied with a few different ways that I was going to reform myself. One of them was
11.
Yeah, and I don't know what got into me, but I thought, I realized that if I did my homework all the time, that I would definitely like be a better student. And that seems like an obvious kind of thing. But I realized like I would be one of those smart kids if I do my homework all the time. So I just decided I'm going to do my homework all the time. And that same year, for some reason, I decided I was going to give up soda and stop watching television. And I just decided it and did it. And as an adult, I sometimes try to tap into that 11-year-old, very self-determinate self and just decide something and go forth. And I'm pretty sure that self is gone. And I don't know if this is an age thing, like maybe old dog, new tricks kind of problem or what?
Oh, my goodness. I love that. I love that because I at first laughed when you said it and said 11. But I remember, can we compare stories?
Please, yes.
I remember, I don't know if I was 11, but I was certainly a teen or an early teen or a preteen. And I was a chubby kid and always got teased and stuff. And I remember picking a kid who everyone liked, and I watched his behavior and decided I would act like him and maybe I wouldn't be picked on. And it worked. I mean, this kid had a way of listening to people. He had a way of you know, doing stuff that was cool. And he was a pretty unassuming kid, but he was sweet and a good-natured kid. And, you know, it worked.
So, do you think that was your first psychology training?
Oh, I think it went back even further than that.
But so what can you learn from that sort of innocent and simple childlike approach to habit formation where, you know, something internal prompts you to say, I'm going to do things this way? Can grown-ups kind of use that?
You're opening a fascinating question, and I absolutely want to address it. You know, when people come for therapy, they are asked the question, you know, what were your parents like, or how did you learn this? And a lot of people resist that, and they think, you know, I don't want to beat my parents up. But during those very important developmental years, it is very, very likely that you will absorb a lot more. And so when people ask, what were your parents like? It's a good question. So during those early years, your head isn't full yet. You haven't developed long-standing patterns. And so it's a very good time to learn habits.
Well, we want to know what ingenious methods you have used to form a good habit or get rid of a bad one. Did it work? Tell us your story at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Bruce Lease and Central Standard. We'll be right back. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Bruce Lease, a professor of family medicine at the University of Kansas Medical Center. He's talking with us this morning about habit formation, and he'll share a little bit of the cognitive side of that process in just a moment. But we want to hear from you at 816-235-2888. We'd like to know what methods you have employed to get rid of a bad habit or to form a good one. 816-235-2888. 2888. And Bruce, you hear a lot about, like, if you do something seven times, it will be a habit. Is that what's the validity of those kinds of myths out there?
Myths is the right word. It's like urban legend. that's more a marketing thing, I think, than anything else. It's an effort to oversimplify an extremely complex process. So,
but I want that to be true.
Me too. I'd like to have a little abacus, and when the last bead goes over, I'll never overeat again. But it really is more marketing than anything. The fact of the matter is that unless you have brain damage of some sort, memories don't go away. And memories include the memory of the delicious food or the memory of the relief you got when you took a hit on a cigarette. So habits are a result of thoughts. And the thoughts themselves are habitual. They just happen so often, over and over and over. So they don't go away. They're not localized in the brain so that we can zap them and forget that we love to eat pasta, pizza, steak, whatever you love, lobster. So, you know, what has to happen is that you have to develop new thoughts that counter the old thoughts, like, God, I'd love to eat that whole pizza, might be the thought. The newer thought would be, I know pizza tastes good, but I also know that it feels so much better when I'm not carrying around an extra 30 pounds or 40 pounds. So thoughts have to change for behaviors to change reliably and durably. And what I've experienced with my patients, I've had patients that have lost hundreds of pounds, 300, 400, 500, 600 pounds over the years. They'll gain, they'll lose, they'll gain, they'll lose, they'll gain, they'll lose. Because when they lose, their thoughts are on, they have their 7 days of whatever, or seven repetitions, but the thoughts come back. And so the challenge, relapse prevention, is all about reintroducing the thoughts that work when the thoughts that you never lost about why it's good to engage in your bad habit, when they start to repenetrate your consciousness.
The repenetration of old thoughts is interesting because I think it is sort of refreshing and fun to think of a new way to think about something. And you think about it that way once and you feel really good. But a thought habit doesn't necessarily form. You do it the one time and then old thought habits kind of creep back in. How do you form a new way of thinking that isn't just a fluke?
repetition is important. The thing about 7 times or 20 times or 21 days or 3 weeks, repetition is important, but there is no set amount of time. So repeating a healthy habit until it is so clear that you're benefiting is where it's at. I'll have people who lose a lot of weight, just as that we'll stick with that example for a while. They'll feel great as they try on clothes that fit, and they'll feel terrible if they try on old clothes that, I mean, they have to go into their bigger clothes. So they get upset that they are starting to gain weight again, and then they think, well, I feel better when I eat. So instead of thinking I'll feel better when I exercise, the relapse, those old penetrating thoughts are just have a bite, just have a brownie, just sit and watch TV. So it's very complex.
Well, let's hear from a caller. We've got Jeff in Richmond, Missouri. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there.
Hi, Jeff.
Hello. How are you, Doctor?
Terrific.
My feeling about breaking bad habits and or building new good habits is that one must have a clear and measurable goal. You can't just say, as your producer said to me, I want to be a better person. Won't work. I'd love to be a better person. What's that mean? I decided in October 1980 I was going to quit smoking. I've been smoking for 30 years. And because of social plans I'd made, I knew I couldn't start it, implement it, until after New Year's. And so my mantra was, not one in 81. Not one. And that's a clear and measurable goal.
So you said you made that decision in October. What did you do to prepare yourself for January between October and January?
I didn't really do a lot. I mean, I knew I was going to quit. We had already invited over 100 people to our home for a New Year's Eve party. And so there was no possibility I was going to make it through the party and not smoke a cigarette if I was a recent quit. But about the middle of the party, I had a half a pack left, and I just took them out of my pocket and laid them on a table, confident that they would go away.
And they did, of course. It helps to have friends, right, Jeff?
Yeah, exactly. But I just knew, you know, that I had to stop because I was having adverse health effects. I was coughing a lot and stuff. But it was a clear and definable. It wasn't like, I'm going to stop someday. I'm going to smoke less. How much is less? Not one in 81. And I did not smoke a cigarette in 1981. In fact, I've only smoked like 3 since then, and those were all in 1 week, and it was due to a divorce from anything. But that's all still excuses. You have to have a clear and definable objective.
How did you not let those 3 set you back all the way?
I don't know. Honestly don't know. I just knew that wasn't me. It wasn't the person I wanted to be. What? I'm in the middle of a weight loss deal now. I drive all the time. I've always eaten when I drive. Candy bars, chips, junk, garbage. So the new rule is no food in the car.
Simple as that.
I lost 15 pounds in 2 months. No food in the car.
Well, thank you, Jeff. I'm going to let Dr. Bruce Lease respond to some of that.
Boy, I think we have 20-something minutes left. I could go on for the entire time based on what Jeff said. Let me try to hit on a number of things. First and foremost, I would say that my favorite thing about this show when we do this every month is the callers. I would rather the experts call in than me talk the whole time, because what Jeff's done is to really represent well what works. And I think it's better coming from people calling. That's why I keep the calls coming in. But I sometimes get people frustrated by expressing what he said. Make your goals clear and measurable. Don't eat brownies. Don't eat cookies. Don't eat. And people say, well, can I have just one? And I say, of course you can have as many as you want, but it's better to have a goal that's so clear and so well-defined that there's no room for cheating. So Jeff and I would have gotten along fine back in 1980 if we were in the same room. And I propose that. But a lot of people don't like that black and white thinking.
Well, he mentioned a mantra, too. Is having something like a mantra helpful?
I wrote that down. Yes. A perfect mantra is, and I use this because I don't, is I don't eat sweets. Of course I'd like sweets as much as everybody else does. But my mantra is I don't eat sweets. If somebody offers dessert, I say, no thanks, I don't eat dessert. Now, of course, I'd love to as much as everybody else with no consequences, if there were no consequences. But mantras like that really help. I don't smoke. I don't drink anymore. I don't eat dessert. It really does help. I don't text in the car. You know, that's a
I like that one.
Yeah, I don't text and drive. I drive 60 miles each way to work, and you wouldn't believe the number of people on the interstate that are in the right lane, the slow lane, looking down at their cell phone texting. That's a habit.
Hey, Bruce, I'm going to take you back to that 8-year-old in your office. How about the mantra, I don't show up late?
Yeah, I don't show up late.
Let's talk to Anita in Overland Park. Hi, Anita.
Good morning.
Hi, Anita.
How are you?
Very good. What can you share with us?
Well, one thing that I have done in terms of forming a habit is something that I've tried to teach others and nobody quite believes me. It revolves around exercise, but I see no reason why it couldn't apply to other things in life. But I tell people to start excruciatingly slowly. For instance, if your goal is to get on the treadmill and get up to 2 or 3 miles a day, you get on the treadmill for 2 minutes, you get off. And of course you're going to say, oh, well, I could do 10 minutes easily. Well, don't. Do 2 minutes, get off. The next day, maybe push it to 3 minutes. Maybe do 3 minutes for a few days. And what happens if you very excruciatingly, slowly build up this habit, it gets to be such a strong habit that it becomes easier to do what it is you want to do. But the trick is starting very slowly.
You've said the word excruciating a couple of times, and I wonder if there's an aspect where maybe by making yourself impatient to go even further rather than exhausting yourself and having to pull back, if that's part of it.
It could be that if you go too long with your exercise and it becomes uncomfortable or you're sore or whatever, or you don't enjoy it, then you have more of a tendency the next day to not do it. So what I meant, I didn't mean it in a painful sense. I just meant in terms of building a habit, the slower you start this habit and build it up slower, the more likelihood it is that it will become a habit and that you will do it every day with almost without even thinking about it. It's just a part of your day eventually.
Anita, right. I'm almost laughing out loud here because there is a nationally renowned expert on behavior change and habit change. And he had trouble with maintaining dental flossing his teeth at night. And Anita, you'll appreciate this. He decided he was going to floss one tooth per night. Talk about excruciatingly slow starts. And he said he just couldn't resist. He had to floss them all. He only went like one or two nights.
That's really interesting.
Isn't that great?
But any sense of the science behind why that would be? Do you
know?
Yes.
That's a very good question. The phrase self-efficacy runs rampant in the literature on habit change. Self-efficacy from the word effective or effectiveness is how confident you are that you can do what you set out to do. So when you have excruciatingly low expectations or goals for a new behavior, you instantly show yourself, I can do it, because your self-efficacy about flossing one tooth or jogging for 1 minute, you know you can do it. You have a high degree of self-efficacy.
And that good feeling is something that compels you forward.
Yeah. When somebody gets stuck in weight loss, the excruciatingly slow goal then is don't gain. I mean, look at the scale, weigh yourself every day. Don't just look at the scale. Actually get on it and weigh yourself.
Yeah,
and,
I see it over there.
But you really don't set any new goals other than keep that weight that you're at. And it's a wonderful idea. Again, I love when callers provide their own experiences because you are the experts.
We have an email from Abigail who says, when I was 11, I noticed in my diary that my penmanship varied from day to day. It really bothered me. So that summer, I decided to change that every day when I wrote very slowly and precisely. By the end of the summer, my penmanship was nearly perfect. I've never forgotten how proud I was of that accomplishment.
11. Oh, that must be a really important year. And I'm serious about that. It's at those times when you're not so occupied with paying mortgages, making sure that your health insurance payments are up to date, et cetera, et cetera. Your life is pretty simple. And at 11 years old, you're a pre-adolescent and you're starting to go into the stage of individuating. You're becoming your own person. And that's when it is your job to determine who you want to be. You just, that's why, Gina, you probably were not rebellious as a kid, but that's why a lot.
Not until later.
That's why a lot of teenagers start getting rebellious in middle school, particularly sixth, seventh, eighth grade, because they're individuating. They're finding themselves. And if that means improving your handwriting or doing your homework, that's a great thing.
That's so interesting because when you mentioned that you don't have to pay a mortgage at that age, the idea that your job is to form good habits, I mean, that's the job of a kid.
Yeah, and that becomes your identity. Your habits, just like the original quote that you had come on air before we started, that is...
Can you remind listeners who might not have heard it what that is?
Yeah, that quote was, it was Aristotle, "We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit." To the extent that we maintain our habits, that becomes who we are.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman talking to Bruce Leese about habit formation and talking to you, too, our callers at 816-235-2888. We've got a call now from Tam in Midtown. Hi, Tam.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I love the show. Thank you very much. It made me think about, I've been in a relationship for 21 years, and at the very beginning of the relationship, we'd both been in partnerships before that had ended because of, you know, mistrust. And my partner and I both decided, sort of as a game at the beginning of this relationship, that if somebody said something that sounded malicious, you weren't allowed to think that. What you had to do as part of the game was say, "That sounded really crappy. Is that what you meant?" And then the other person had the opportunity, of course, to say, "Well, no," which is what it was most of the time. And so what started out as a game became a habit. And about 9 months into the relationship, we'd gone back to the West Coast to visit some friends of mine. And my partner told a story about me that wasn't very it was funny, but it wasn't very flattering. And when she left the room, the other person said, "Are you kidding? What, you know, why would she say a thing like that?" And I said, "She didn't mean anything by it." And I realized that this habit of it had become a habit to never think she was saying something malicious.
Interesting.
And so it started as a game, became a habit, and then became a lifestyle because we've been together 21 years now.
Congratulations. So,
well, thank you. But,
yeah, that's
I tell other people about this and nobody believes me. So
that you can have thought habits, Bruce Leese, and that they can involve. We've talked a lot about habits involving only yourself and your own decisions, but this idea that a relationship can have habits.
Yeah, I have absolutely no idea whether anyone who's ever seen me for couples counseling is listening, but what I'm about to say, somewhere between zero and hundreds of people will be nodding as I say the following. When I do couples counseling, which is something I do a lot of, and also family counseling, there is a rule that starts in the first visit, and that rule is that you will never bicker again. Bickering is a horrible, horrible habit.
How would you define that?
Thanks for asking. I thought you'd never ask. No, bickering is when person A states their opinion, person B states their opinion. Their opinions contrast. And they both decide they're going to keep arguing for their position. Even if it happens once, I'll have a couple who he'll say something, she'll say something. And as soon as he says something to correct her, I say, "You're already bickering." So bickering is when you take your argument beyond the first statement. Now, a discussion about differences is fine. The difference between arguing and or bickering and collaborative conversation, I think, just should be intuitively obvious. But bickering is a terrible habit, and it follows the belief that I've got to make this person understand my position and agree with it. If that is what you're thinking, you need to agree with me. I was right. I am right. You are wrong, and you need to see it my way. the coolest thing I think I've discovered in all the years I've been doing marriage counseling and couples counseling is that people can actually stop bickering. And this is not a marketing campaign, but people can stop bickering in a week. I've had people come back and I'll say, so did you bicker? And they'll say, surprisingly, we didn't. Since you told us to stop. Because if you recognize, tell your partner or tell your kids, this is the deal. The other person can disagree, but you say, you know my opinion on it. We're done.
That's fascinating. So knowing when to stop, too.
That's right.
Well, let's talk to Michael in Ottawa, Kansas. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I have some interesting things, tricks I played on myself when I gave up smoking, which was 30 years ago or so. I discovered that what I liked about smoking, aside from the chemical effect of the nicotine, was where the air hit the back of my throat when I inhaled. So I would just use a soda straw and suck in and aim the airflow at that point in the back of my throat. That provided actually some relief. And the other thing I did was I didn't set a date, a solid date, you know, no smoking after this certain date. Kind of floated along, kept trying to quit. And every time I would want a cigarette and get one, I would buy a pack, smoke the cigarette, and then put the pack under a faucet and soak it with water so it was ruined. And that went on for, I'm not sure how long. I eventually gave up smoking, but I can't give you an exact date at all when I quit.
Good for you, Michael. What are you hearing in that, Bruce Lee?
Oh, of course, a million things. Can we have an extra hour today for the rest of the show?
I wish.
So, Michael, you are among the many thousands of people who say that one of the most important aesthetic components of smoking is that people have described it as tingling at the back of their throat, kind of a sharp feeling. You called it a kind of air blowing on it. So your solution was terrific, wonderful, because to the extent that you can adapt and still get the same effect from a healthier habit, you got it licked. But there were other things that you said that I thought were really interesting, and we haven't yet talked about context. Habits are context dependent.
Does that mean that there's like a cue in your environment that sets you into a certain behavior?
Yeah, I mean, picture yourself. Let's just pretend, you know, you have a big, let's just pretend that you just were pulled over by a state trooper for doing 65 in the 45-mile-an-hour zone.
I wish I couldn't imagine this.
That's not the point at which you start salivating because you're in the mood for steak or lobster or peanut butter and jelly. I mean, it's so out of context that you would get into that. You'd think about the habit of eating at that moment. So people who want to change habits, who want to change good ones for bad ones, can and should and do change their environment. So, you know, having a pack of cigarettes is part of the context. To the extent that Michael destroyed the cigarettes, he destroyed the context of having cigarettes accessible.
But he didn't destroy the convenience store down the street.
Right, that's probably good. I'm glad he used the match to light the cigarette and then threw them all away instead of torching the convenience store.
But that does bring up, the world offers you all sorts of things, all sorts of vices and it can't be the case that you can just eliminate all, you can't control the whole world.
Right, and you can't control the context. I was once told, and this may or may not be true, but when malls were a big thing, I understood that they used to pipe the smells of foods that would make people hungry through the vents, through the ducts.
I've heard that too.
Yeah, it may be another urban legend, but context is everything. I find myself going faster than I should in my car. At times when I'm on roads that I've just done that before, when I'm not even in a hurry to get somewhere. So
we're going to go now to Marie in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Marie.
Hi.
Hi, Marie.
Tell us your story.
Okay. My habit is more, when I was probably a child, I started the bad habit of comfort eating. And, you know, when I would get a sad feeling or a mad feeling or whatever, I would eat. And I'm 44 years old now and went through all the stream of eating disorders. But just about 6 months ago, it makes me very unhappy that I am overweight. It makes me socially uncomfortable. I don't, you know, the clothes that I would like to wear, I can't wear. And only about 6 months ago, I had something that just really bothered me. I was disappointed because something didn't go the way that I wanted. And I had, it actually became a thought instead of just the compulsion. I thought, you know, yeah, I deserve that ice cream. And I then thought, well, no, the real treat would be not to eat the ice cream.
Perfect.
Because then I won't gain the weight and I can wear the, you know, the clothes that don't fit me anymore. I won't feel so crappy. Things will roll off my back better, you know?
That is such an, thank you so much for sharing that, Marie.
That goes back. Yes, thank you. Back to what I said. I love people calling and talking about what they're expert at. So what's important there is that those old thoughts, an ice cream would be wonderful now, don't die. They exist, and you've got to beat them up with the new healthier thoughts like it's awesome to be in good shape.
And it also seems like it, she took what the thought that she had a habit of having, which is I deserve this, and built off of that.
I deserve to be healthy.
Yes.
Yeah. Perfect.
What do you think are some of the pitfalls of falling back into old habits? What do you think are some of the reasons that happens?
Well, the old memories do get activated. It's just like there are things in life we remember and things in life we don't. We tend to remember things that have a high degree of emotional salience. In other words, they were particularly emphasized or important in our own minds. So you wouldn't remember your 37th kiss with your spouse, but you certainly will remember your first with, if not your spouse, you know, your first boyfriend or girlfriend. So the more emotionally significant or salient something is, the more you remember it. And in our society, in our culture, food is associated with, cigarette smoking is associated with, going to the track if you're a gambler is associated with celebrations and fun and music and jumping up and down and screaming and clapping your hands. So the more salient, emotionally salient an old behavior is, the more likely it is it's going to come back and remind you, here I am, do me, come on.
Well, you know, we've mentioned a couple of times how much easier it is to form a habit as children. And the idea of eating, for example, being a reward kind of thing, is that something that can be dissuaded in childhood?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, in families where people are introduced to healthy eating as something that's just wonderful and terrific, you know, God, look at the beauty. Look at these beautiful apples. Look at this. Look how fresh the fruit is. Or, oh, I found a new whole wheat bread that's full of, you know, all kinds of healthy nutrients. If that's what kids hear all the time and the right amounts of food are served in childhood, the memory will be of eating healthy. If after a meal there's a walk on a regular basis or a bicycle ride on a regular basis, or if people talk to each other nicely afterwards, you know, people get used to sitting at the table and talking nicely.
I love sitting at the table and talking nicely. Thank you so much, Bruce Lee.
Oh, thank you. It's always my pleasure.
Buy you something, but I caught myself in time. And nothing makes any sense anymore, but everything. Die.
all the time we have for today's conversation. I want to thank Bruce Lease, professor of family medicine at KU Medical Center. To listen back to today's show, go to kcur.org/Central Standard. Stay current on Central Standard News by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @KCURCST. Tune in tomorrow for a talk about Maya Angelou with local artists who have been influenced by her life and her work. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.